Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help the military community thrive in their civilian career. Today's episode number 369, How to Buy and Grow a Company with Charles Mullinger.
Yeah, I gave that pitch in those 30 days especially. Lord knows how many times I was pretty hopped up on coffee because I really was just having coffee chats all day, every day. But, you know, I would just sit down with them and explain, listen, I'm a local St. Louis guy. I was born and raised here. My wife was born and raised here. I went off, served in the military for 5 years after graduating West Point, and then went to get an MBA at Booth. I spent the last year and a half at an investing firm here in town. And now I've gone off on my own and I have investor backing to look for a small business to buy that I'm going to operate. My heart is really with staying in the St. Louis community and being a part of all the great things that are happening in the city. And, you know, here's the type of businesses that I think would be a good fit for me. But if you happen to know anyone who is potentially thinking about selling, I'd love for you to connect with me.
I reached out to Charles about 6 months ago, and I'm so happy that I was finally able to get him on the show. In this interview, we talk a lot about building up specific skills in one's career. In Charles' case, he learned skills at business school and then in private equity, which both were in line with his eventual career goal of entrepreneurship. And we talk about a form of entrepreneurship you've probably never heard about, search funds. So many veterans want to run a company, but don't know where to start. A search fund is a way to buy an existing business and then build and grow it. Actually, for most of my time at Stanford Business School, I thought I would do a search fund, and I still believe it's an incredible career path for many veterans. As I mentioned, I reached out to Charles 6 months ago based on his background. I don't really think I realized how incredibly smart and capable he was until I had this conversation. As an entrepreneur myself, I'm blown away by the moves this guy has and on his ability to explain them to our audience. If you do like this episode, check out episode number 117, Jim Vesterman, Marine Corps to Search Funds and Buying a Company to Run, which I'll list in the show notes for this episode at beyondtheuniform.org. And of course, this interview was only made possible due to the financial support of the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management. And I want to share a little bit more about them. Whether you're transitioning to a civilian career or continuing military service, an MBA from Carlson at the University of Minnesota prepares you for a high-impact career in business. Carlson is committed to the veteran community and provides the benefits, experiential learning, and network to accelerate your career. In addition to a resident tuition waiver, all admitted full-time MBA military candidates receive generous scholarships and stipends to cover expenses that may not be eligible for the GI Bill. To learn more, you can visit the show notes at beyondtheuniform.org for this episode, or you can email mba@umn.edu. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Charles. Joining me today in St. Louis, Missouri, my guest is Charles Mullinger. Charles, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
And for listeners, I reached out to Charles a long time ago, and I'm so grateful to have him on the show and that this finally worked out. Let me give you all a quick bio on Charles. He is the CEO and president of Ethos Preparedness, which has been building the most trusted brands in preparedness, starting with MedSled since 2004. He's a 2010 graduate of West Point and served as a field artillery officer in the Army for 5 years before obtaining his MBA at the Chicago's Booth School of Business. He has served on the board of directors for Purity Zinc Metals for over 5 years and founded Steel Tree Capital, which led to his involvement in Ethos Preparedness. So maybe, Charles, to start things off, anything to add or amend to that bio?
No, that is the bio. Got out of the military, and what most people do out of the military don't know what they want to do. So I decided to go to business school and focused my efforts on investing in entrepreneurial activity. So here I am today.
Was that something you were thinking of pre-business school, or was that something that kind of emerged when you were there?
It more so emerged while I was there. I was introduced to the investing vehicle called a search fund or entrepreneurship through acquisition in my first year, and really fell in love with the idea. I didn't take the leap immediately out of school, but I think in my heart, I kind of knew that it was a path that I really wanted to take to lead a small team again and help build a business.
And for listeners, when I was at business school, the whole time I was there up until maybe 8 months before I graduated, I thought I would do what Charles actually did, which is called a search fund. So maybe just to set the foundation on that, what is a search fund?
Yeah, so a search fund is an investment vehicle whereby an entrepreneur is backed by a group of investors to search for a business for a period of usually up to 2 years, to search for a business to purchase that entrepreneur would then operate. Typically, they step into the president or CEO position of the company and have a board of directors that are made up of investors who have skin in the game. There's different ways to go about it, but that's the most typical path. And the entrepreneur ends up taking the helm at that operation and tries to build the business and create more value than was there before when they found it.
One of the things that appealed to me about this and may appeal to listeners is, you know, if you start a company, you're starting with yourself and then maybe growing it into 2 and then 5 employees and 10 employees. The appealing thing about what Charles did is after, you know, the search, which we'll get into, but after a search that often takes a year, 2-3 years to find that company, you're purchasing an established company that could have 10, 20, 30 employees. So it's almost like a much more efficient way to be in charge of a more established organization. And my theory in business school, and it still holds today, is most vets that love managing people and managing a team, this is a much faster way to get there than starting something from scratch.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely right. And that's exactly where my head was as well. I simply loved being a platoon leader. And when I learned about this investment vehicle at business school, I just kind of took a step back and said, wait a second, they actually will let a young guy come in into a leadership position and have the backing of people who, you know, see the vision, find a good business to operate. And to me, it was just an incredibly exciting and potentially rewarding career. So I'm very glad I went down the path and having a lot of fun with it.
You mentioned, I want to kind of track your progress from business school to actually doing the search fund, but you kind of get the seed planted in business school. How did you approach that decision of whether to enter into entrepreneurship immediately through this search fund versus getting more experience first? Like what was the reasoning for the delay there?
Yeah, I think veterans especially, you know, I've known plenty of veterans who come out of business school and take the search fund path immediately. For me, I really just felt like I needed some real-time business experience. And I landed a great opportunity at a family office private equity firm here in my hometown of St. Louis. And the role was very operationally focused, but I also got some transactions under my belt. So I got to do a little bit of investing and due diligence experience, but I also got to do strategic projects for the companies that the family office owned. And that was just great experience for me to kind of cut my teeth and feel like I had the confidence to go out and run a small business. So, you know, I think it was a good path for me. There, you know, everyone's going to have a different path towards ETA if that's something you want to do in the future. But the way that it shaped up for me was great.
And I'll say, as someone who went from business school to starting a startup, there's so much that I learned through mistakes that I didn't need to learn through mistakes. Like, you know, there's, in retrospect, so much new about business versus the military that I really had to reinvent. And I look back and I'm like, man, if I had a year or two at any company, it would have really served me well to learn these things that I could apply, because then you're really just inventing around a tiny piece of the company rather than every aspect of the admin and financials and everything that you have to do from the ground up. And one other thing I wanted to point out for our listeners, it's hard to find veterans with experience in private equity. I think we've only had one or two interviews and 370 of these things. But just for context, private equity, and definitely correct me on this, Charles, but it's essentially people who are investing in established companies and helping them. It's kind of like the bridge between venture capital and going public. They're dealing with a later stage company. And a search fund, in my view, it's a private equity company of just one or two individuals rather than 20 people. You're one or two people, you make one investment, and then you go on to run that company. Bigger private equity companies are doing lots of investments, and they may put in a management team, but the people investing are generally not the people operating. And I just wanted to say that for context of listeners, of the brilliance, in my view, of what Charles did is he went to get private equity experience. He got to learn about looking at deals and evaluating companies and getting that skill set of saying, like, is this company worth investing in? And he got that experience while being paid. And then I'm sure, as we'll get into, he was able to apply that to then doing it independently. So feel free to correct or add to any of that.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. And that's exactly where my thought process was when that opportunity came about. I mean, I was married at the time. I had my first child. I had looked at consulting, and I actually did my MBA internship in management consulting and had an offer to go back to the firm that I was at. But I really liked the idea of getting that transactional experience, because a search fund really was in my heart to do in the future. And I felt if I wanted to take that leap, then I would really want to have some deal experience and have that investing experience. I mean, you really hit the nail on the head when you said just looking at companies over and over again and determining which ones are worthwhile investments. That's a really strong skill set to have. And I was very fortunate to have it for about 18 months before I decided to take the plunge into a search fund.
And so, you know, I think sometimes in retrospect, we can put the line together that's not there, but it really does sound like in this case, you left the military, went to business school, learned about this investment vehicle, and then decided consciously, I'm going to get more experience and then go do this. And that's exactly what you did. You kind of charted this, looks like, you know, 2-3 year path, and then went on execution mode.
Yeah. You know, I think if you had asked me that during my second year at business school, it might not have sounded that well thought out. But, you know, I like I said, I just looked at the opportunity that was put in front of me. And I said, you know, this is going to give me the skill set that I think I want and that I think I'm going to enjoy. And it ended up being that I still had the itch to go do a search in the future. And that's why my heart led me to where I am.
It's interesting. I'm just putting together for myself right now. When I was in business school, I decided the only way I would do a search fund was if I was partnered with someone who had private equity experience. And ultimately, the reason I didn't do it was because there were three people in my class that went on to search funds. All of them did it individually, and all of them had private equity experience. And what you did that I didn't even consider was saying, like, I will go and I will get that skill set for myself. Like, it almost seems like you realize this is a pretty big skill set that I need. I'm just, you know, narrating out loud for listeners. It's like, if I think of the search fund process, which is look for a company for a couple of years, buy it, and then run it. If I'm evaluating you as someone I'm giving money to, I'm like, okay, ability to lead and run a company, check. Between mostly military, but also business school, I would have faith in you for that. I would be a little bit concerned about the search process. And so you've, like, built up your career capital and your resume around that specific skill set. That's pretty impressive. I don't think I've seen that often.
Yeah. I mean, it's, like I said, there's so many different ways to go about it. I mean, doing a search fund now, there's incubators. So I know a fellow West Point graduate who joined Search Fund Accelerator out of Boston. And that is essentially, you become an entrepreneur in residence there. And it is an accelerator. You spend the 2 years looking for a business while you're there to end up purchasing, and you have the backing of that accelerator who's training you along the way. There's another great one in Chicago called Next Gen Growth Partners, who I actually did an internship with while I was at Booth. But there's so many different ways to end up in the search seat, if you will. The way that I did it worked out for me, and I think I wanted a little more autonomy than one of those accelerators might have provided, because I did a geographical search. I wanted to find a company in the St. Louis area or potentially Nashville or Chicago, just based on professional contacts and family. My wife and I, we have two daughters now, and we have our third child on the way. So I just wanted to be somewhere that I knew we'd want to be long-term, and it ended up working out really well for us.
What are the other ways you could do this? You said you did a geographic search. What are the alternatives?
So most searchers, the expectation from the investors, unless you have this discussion with them up front, is that you will do a national search. Especially in a city like St. Louis, there's only going to be so many opportunities. I have plenty of friends who did just a Texas search, but the majority of searchers are looking nationwide, and they typically go for an industry focus. So you'll build a thesis around an industry that you believe is ripe for an investment and you believe is ripe for growth. And you will typically just scan the United States looking for businesses in that industry, two or three industries that you built a thesis around. And when you find those targets, you go out and meet those owners. So if you are doing a search, more often than not, you are going to need to be mobile and be ready to move to wherever that business is.
That again, you know, so the way that I viewed this, I'm curious if this matched your view of it, Charles. But when I was in business school, I was like, well, a lot of times search funds, one of the competitive advantages is, you know, some of these companies, like one of the ones I'm thinking of was like a sewage company in like Arkansas or something crazy like that. And part of the competitive advantage is like, okay, how many top MBA graduates are willing to go to that sort of location and then work in this quote unquote non-sexy vertical. And one of the reasons why I always thought that this would be appealing to veterans is, you know, and I even told this to the investors I was meeting with, is like, man, I've been moving around my entire military career. I've like been uprooted so many different times. So if you're telling me I'm going to get uprooted and, you know, put in the middle of Timbuktu, it doesn't really matter. I'm used to that. So right. If you have that hired gun mentality and you're willing to go anywhere, that's an opportunity to discover a deal. But one thing that I'll say about Charles's journey that I think applies to everyone, regardless of what you're looking at, is there is a gift in narrowing our focus. And we've talked about before on the show, the incredible liability it is. If you say, I'm a Swiss Army knife, I'll do anything, I'll go anywhere. It's just impossible to help someone like that. But in Charles's case, where he's like, look, I'm looking at a broad set of opportunities, but it needs to be in St. Louis. My opinion is that actually provides more freedom. It makes things a lot easier because he's ruled out a lot of things. It's not like he's boiling the ocean now for a solution. He's looking in a very specific area. And one of the things I wanted to ask about, Charles, is when you finish up your time at in private equity, could you walk through the process of starting Steel Tree Capital and then up until you found the company that you ended up purchasing?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing you want to do is you're going to put together a private placement memorandum, or a PPM. So that PPM is essentially your pitch deck, if you will, of, hey, here's who I am. Here's my experience. Here's really why I want to do this. Here's the industries I'm interested in. And it's basically, it's as if you are starting up a new company and you're speaking to Shark Tank type investors and you say, hey, here, this is why I'm going to do this. So once you kind of get people on board, the next step is actually launching the search. So for me, because I was geographically focused, I really spent a ton of time in the first like 30 days just pounding the pavement in St. Louis, Missouri, and meeting with anyone who could potentially be coming across business owners that may be interested in selling. So I sat down and had coffee with private wealth managers and accountants and lawyers and business brokers and private equity people, just basically making sure everyone in town knew what I was up to. From there, I started getting a little bit of deal flow through that process. And then I started my direct outreach campaigns to business owners around the area. And the interesting thing about a geographical search is you usually have a really cool story to tell around it. So my wife and I are both from St. Louis, Missouri. And I think that story really resonated with a lot of business owners. So I think my reply rate from business owners was probably higher than most searchers. Because if you think about it, if you're in a, you know, the 21st floor in Boston or Chicago, reaching out to an HVAC company in Little Rock, Arkansas, it's a tougher story to sell than if you're actually in town and you say, hey, I would love to treat you to coffee and learn about your business. So that process was great. I got to meet a lot of really cool business owners around St. Louis. And one of the intermediary relationships that I had was a boutique investment bank in St. Louis. And a gentleman who I knew just through my previous job, and once he found out what I was doing, called me up and told me about an opportunity that he was about to put to market. And that was the MedSled business. And really hit the ground running with that. But it made my search very short and very lucky, because I found an opportunity that just really fit well with me. And it checked the majority of the marks that I was looking for in an investment opportunity. And like I said, hit the ground running with it, and it ended up working out.
And so there's a couple of things we'll rewind and unpack, because there's a lot there. So the way that I understand it, and for listeners, is when you're in that very first thing, when you're raising money, you're essentially raising a range, and we'll talk about that, what that range is. But let's just say a range of money that's essentially paying your salary for a few years to search, and some money to be able to go to trade shows and travel and things like that. You're not going to be making, from what I understand, a killer salary, but enough money to live off of and look for this company. And then you're going to be going back to those investors once you find the company and say, hey, you gave me 25 cents a year and a half ago, and I lived off of that, and I found this company. Now, would you give me a dollar towards buying this company? And let me just pause there. And could you, you know, fill in or correct anything around that kind of fundraising process?
Yeah. So that is, you said it very well. That's pretty much exactly how it goes. Now, to add a little, another wrinkle into it, my scenario was a little bit different. I did what is, some people call it a self-funded search. So I didn't necessarily need to raise. Typically, as a single searcher, you're going to raise anywhere from $300,000 to $450,000 to cover your expenses, travel, pay for that two-year period. For me, my wife was working, so I did not need a salary. And then number two, because I was doing a local search, I had almost no overhead. I wasn't getting on a plane all the time to go to industry conferences or going to meet with business owners in random towns. I was hopping in the car and driving down the street. So for me, I didn't need to raise that capital, but what I did was I built up a group of about 8 investors, who I told them what I was up to, and they said, yeah, absolutely. When deals come across your desk that you're interested in, we'd be interested in backing you. So I was just actually looking for the capital to fund the business purchase, as opposed to funding the 2-year search.
And I'm imagining one of the advantages of that is that then you're giving away less ownership in the company that you end up purchasing, because you have to raise less money. Is that fair?
Yeah. So search fund economics typically are about the same. You have the opportunity to earn up to 25% of the equity of the business. So you'll start off with 8 1/3% just by making the acquisition of the company. Another 8 1/3% will vest over a 4-year period while you're operating. And then the final 8 1/3% is earned by providing a certain internal rate of return for the investors who actually funded the business purchase with their equity.
That's great. I love too, you know, you're highlighting so many advantages to this geographic search, not just that money saved, but in this, the next thing I wanted to ask about, this networking component. I just imagine, you know, if I was flying to Las Vegas and then flying to Minneapolis, like there's not a lot of neutrons that hit each other to like lead to serendipity. But because, you know, you're talking to one person who may know someone else who knows a neighbor, and you're just kind of like, you're a part of the community. It seems like the chance of someone saying like, oh man, you should talk to Charles. It just seems like that's so much more likely. And one of the things I wanted to ask about is, as you were, you know, you said that 30 days of just pounding the pavement, I'm guessing that you, and this is maybe reaching back a little bit, but I'm guessing you had a little bit of an elevator pitch of saying like, this is who I am, this is what I'm looking for. And could you just kind of like shooting from the hip, give us, you know, you run into someone who seems like they would be a good contact. What is it that you're saying to them that's your elevator pitch?
Yeah, I mean, I gave that pitch in those 30 days, especially, Lord knows how many times. I was pretty hopped up on coffee because I really was just having coffee chats all day, every day. But, you know, I would just sit down with them and explain, listen, I'm a local St. Louis guy. I was born and raised here. My wife was born and raised here. I went off, served in the military for 5 years after graduating West Point, and then went to get an MBA at Booth. I spent the last year and a half at an investing firm here in town, and now I've gone off on my own, and I have investor backing to look for a small business to buy that I'm going to operate. My heart is really with staying in the St. Louis community and being a part of all the great things that are happening in the city. And, you know, here's the type of businesses that I think would be a good fit for me. But if you happen to know anyone who is potentially thinking about selling, I'd love for you to connect me with them.
Beautiful. I think that's just like a textbook. That's a case study and a great elevator pitch where I instantly get what Charles is about. I instantly get what he's looking for. And for listeners, I just want to bookmark this because, you know, comparing that to jack of all trades, immediately for me, even just hearing this right now, I'm like, okay, who do I know in St. Louis who meets? It just makes it easier for me to go through my Rolodex to think of like, how can I help him? Because my guess is, especially with Charles leading with West Point and with Army, most people, 99% of the American population, their heart's going to go out and want to help him. But the rest of that pitch is making it easy for them to help him because they understand, okay, who are the one or two or three people I know that I could help him out with by making an introduction. So that's great. And how long did it take for you to find the company?
So my search was actually 5 months long, which is pretty quick in the world of entrepreneurship through acquisition. But like I said, I just got lucky. A good deal was put in front of me, I think in maybe my second month of searching, and went to have dinner with the founder and his wife and the president of the company. And we all just really hit it off and started due diligence pretty quickly. And, you know, it was a 3.5 month diligence process. So there was some get to know you time, but because he was marketing his company, I knew for a fact that he wanted to sell. So I was able to speed up the conversations, and I knew that there may be some other players in the game looking at potentially buying the business. But I think as far as the length of my search, it was super lucky and just very serendipitous.
And my perception was always that it was usually a 2 or even 3 year process to search for that company. So 5 months is like a sprint. And I love that. Could you talk a little bit? And I know this probably touches on the private equity experience, but for listeners, what does that search even look like? I'm sure. Actually, about how many companies did you take a look at, and then also just describe, like, what are you looking at when you're an external party kicking the tires on a business?
Yeah. So to answer your first question, I think because my search was so fast, my numbers really aren't that high, and I wasn't doing a national search. So businesses that I actually took a very serious look at and had a serious conversation with the owner, probably 20 to 30, somewhere in there. There was one other business that I submitted an indication of interest. And that's like the first step of putting in an offer on a business. And the owner, we were just too far apart from what he wanted and what I was willing to pay for it. So that one went away. And then the MedSled opportunity came about, and I went after it. Remind me the second part of your question, Justin, I'm sorry.
Oh, just like describe like what is taking a look at a company look like?
Yeah. So I think first things first is you look at the industry that they're in. So you're going to do a market analysis on it and try and size the market, see how big it is, see how good of a player in the market this is. You're going to do some research around the reputation of the company. My company is very product oriented. So I wanted to make sure that customer reviews were very strong and that there was a good brand name out in the marketplace with it. And then from there, once you're able to put a valuation on it around seeing some of the financials and putting a value on the company, then the bed covers come back a little bit and you can start asking a lot more pinpointed questions and getting more information from the owner of the business who's willing to provide that company information since you put in an offer that they may be interested in. So from there, it becomes, all right, now you're in full due diligence on the financials, the operations, HR, accounting, marketing, sales, all of the main functions of a business, and just trying to learn as much as you can and make sure that if there are any red flags, you can uncover them and see if that's something that you're willing to risk or not.
I love that. And I'll just kind of, you know, to try and provide some point of comparison, having spent 10 plus years in startups, I feel like I'm pretty good at quickly putting the dots together of like, okay, what's the size of the opportunity here? What's the competitive landscape? What's the keys to making this business succeed? that's, in my perception, like 10 to 15, 20% of what Charles is talking about, like the skill set that he acquired through a year and a half of working in private equity, like his ability to look at a business, look at the numbers, and like very quickly say, like, this thing's got legs or not, completely out of my wheelhouse. I would have no idea how to approach that. But it's you can see why, you can actually see why that skill set is so valuable. There's so many different things beyond search funds where that could be really helpful. Even in thinking about investing on a personal basis, just being able to quickly understand what makes a business succeed. And I also want to call out, you know, Charles said that he took a deep look at 20 or 30 companies. I'm guessing that, you know, the Malcolm Gladwell blink that you built up in evaluating so many deals in private equity, I bet that, you know, you ran into someone at the bar and they're like, oh, you should talk to my cousin Eddie who runs this company. You probably were able to quickly say like, nope, not a good fit already. I didn't even have to look at the business. I know this isn't a good fit for XYZ reasons. And that just ultimately saves you time. Versus me, if I was in that same situation, I'd probably be chasing down 100 of these things and spreading myself thin because I'm not able to quickly get things out of my pipeline.
Yeah, there's definitely truth behind that. The firm that I was with before I took this leap was, we pretty much focused on manufacturing companies. So I was very well versed on manufacturing and specialty manufacturing specifically. So I think when I would come across a services business, for example, I may not have that immediate reaction. So I would need to dig a little bit deeper. But if there was something around manufacturing, or if it was around any of the types of products that the companies that my firm owned, if they were manufacturing those types of products, I would definitely be able to understand the industry. But, you know, I want to harp on the fact that part is so important, especially as a young entrepreneur, like getting those reps in and understanding how to evaluate an industry quickly. That is an absolute skill set that I think anyone jumping into business should be able to have. And it's going to pay dividends for you in the future.
And one other thing I want to call out too, another reason why I think that search funds, there should be some search fund organization paying us money for this interview, because we're really selling search funds, and there's no way to make money off of that. But the other thing I think that veterans would love about this approach is myself, I'm imagining for Charles, most veterans I speak with, we kind of leave the military and it's not like we have a clear direction of like, I want to go do drones or Bitcoin or whatever it is. Few people I know have that level of clarity. Yeah. But search funds, one of the great things about this is that's an asset. Because, you know, I'm imagining as you're looking at companies, you're looking at lots of different companies. And it's almost like, okay, when I find a good deal, I'll get passionate about that company because it's my company, versus saying like, I'm really fired up about, you know, sewage systems, and therefore I'm just going to look at that. So it's like, it's just another way where what traditionally is an Achilles heel for veterans of not knowing a specific industry, you can kind of turn that to your advantage and say, look, if I see a screaming deal in any industry, I'm going to go for that. And I'll learn, you know, I'll learn what I need to about it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think military officers especially are very well versed in being able to do that. Because if I look at my career as an artillery officer, I was a platoon leader one day, and then I was a fire support officer the next day in an infantry unit, leading up and helping advise an infantry company commander. And then the next day I'd go back to an artillery battery and I would be a fire direction officer. So we get put in leadership positions that are different all the time. And that's no different in the business environment. You don't have to be an expert. You need to be one term that I had a professor at Booth who said this all the time. You need to be a business athlete. And I think that is something that veterans can be very good at, because we are able to adapt to change very quickly because we're very used to it. And we're comfortable in it, to be honest. It doesn't scare us. It's kind of like, all right, cool. Here's another challenge. Here's a new role. I've been down this path before. So I think veterans need to understand when they get out and they look at all of these different opportunities, it's more so, where do you think you're going to be happy, and what is going to make you really excited when you wake up? Because if you are a go-getting human being, which a lot of former military people are, you're going to be fine. You're going to learn it. You're not going to have all the answers on day one, and that's perfectly okay.
That's great. I love that business athlete too. What was it for MedSled? Like when you saw it, describe kind of where the company was at. I know it was kind of an 8-month process of looking at them, but where they were at when you were first starting the conversation, and what was it about them that you know, I imagine the romantic meeting eyes with the girl of your dreams across the room. Like what was it that sparked this attraction?
Yeah. I mean, I found out about the business and I knew the products well enough. So we do have a tactical line of products that we sell to military and law enforcement. They're flexible litters. So I was intimately familiar with how to use the products. And then I looked at what they had done with the company outside of the tactical side. So we have a very strong presence in hospitals. So anytime you need to move a non-ambulatory person out of a hospital in a mass evacuation scenario, it's probably done on a MedSled. And our line of products goes from moving the youngest baby in the NICU all the way up to your bariatric heaviest patient. And I looked at this line of products and I said, wow, that they have to have a good foothold in the unique niche that they play in. So I really did strong diligence around that. They're in thousands of hospitals around the United States. It's a very well-received product. It's a very necessary product that some regulations actually require. So there was just a lot of great things about the company. And I looked at the team and I was excited about the way the business was structured from an HR and from an org structure standpoint. And then finally, I looked at the industry that they played in from a macro level. So we owned this little niche, but I looked at the emergency preparedness industry as a whole. And I said, you know, I really think there's a play in this industry to have specialty products and to be able to provide a full suite of solutions, whether that is to families, individuals, or organizations. And I kind of took that thesis and ran with it. And here we are today, 18 months later, and things are going pretty well.
What I love about that is the I view it as it's like thinking around a corner where I think it's easy for me to look at this and say, okay, the MedSled, it's easy to see how you could scale that in a linear fashion.
Right. But
that last piece that Charles is talking about, and again, from my limited understanding of search funds, the ones that have done really well were the ones that didn't just continue linearly growing. They saw the opportunity to expand into something related, but not the same. Like they were able to provide new products or new services or something that allowed it to be more exponential. And I love that you're pointing out that you did that. You kind of looked and said, okay, they own their swim lane. Can they take over the whole pool? Is there a couple adjacent swim lanes that they could spill into that then makes this more and more appealing? And I just want to go back to the numbers that Charles was sharing at the start, that 8 1/3, 8 1/3, 8 1/3. He is incentivized to find something that he can grow as big as possible. That's one of the things about entrepreneurship. He has major ownership in this company. So the bigger he can make it, the better. And how many employees was the company when you ended up buying it?
So it was, when I first bought it, it was 14, and right now we're at 16. So we have brought on a couple new hires, and there was some transition in people at the beginning that just needed to happen. But as far as employee growth, the majority of that growth actually came from an add-on acquisition that we did about 6 months ago, which I think you'll probably be asking me about. But we do have, we just brought on a digital marketing manager who's been a fantastic hire for us, and we're really trying to increase our digital presence. And then we do have in our sights a few hires that we think we're going to need to make in order to achieve the growth that we hope. But COVID-19 has obviously put a wrench into the plans of every small business. So we are, we're treading lightly, but you know, I think we are operating in an industry that will have tailwinds for the foreseeable future. There's definitely not going to be a lack of attention to preparedness following this event. So I think we'll be in a good spot.
That's great. And reaching back, you know, 10 years in business school, I remember people saying, like, when you acquire these companies, I remember the advice being like, look, the first year, you're just kind of getting the lay of the land. You're not making major changes in the first 6 to 12 months. You're getting to know your team. You're figuring out who you want to keep and who maybe might not be a jockey for the next leg of the race. Could you kind of share what that first 30 days or, you know, what was that first period when you first, it's gotta be similar to, you know, in the Navy perspective, taking over as captain of a new ship. Like, what was that first 30 days like now being the man in charge of this company? And then zooming out, what does the first year look like for you?
Yeah. So the first 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, it's what you learn when you're at one of the academies or what you learn when you're a new lieutenant. It's, you just got to listen to people. You're there to learn. You are not providing value yet. And trying to learn and asking the right questions is going to prove to people that you want to provide value and that you're there for the right reasons. So those first 60, 90 days, I was just trying to sit down with everyone on the team, get to know them one-on-one, understand what people's motivations are, what really makes them tick, why they're good at their job, how they've become successful at the job or the role, the function that they're in. Beyond that, it became trying to get on the road as much as I possibly could. I think we're a sales-driven organization, so getting on the road with people, and even last year I took a few international trips just trying to understand markets around the globe a little bit better and understanding how our products can fit into different markets. That was really important for my growth as a leader in this company. Going past that first 60, 90 days through the whole year, you know, I think that's when strategic planning started. So once I felt like I had learned enough, so let's think, I acquired the business in March of 19, and I think I had put together a strategy for 2020 by about November, and I presented it to the team. We did an offsite at a local brewery here in St. Louis and presented the strategy and said, hey, here's the three or four things we're really going to focus on 2020 that I think is going to elevate our company to the next level and really, really make us a platform for growth in the future. And obviously there's been some pivots to be had in COVID-19, but all the things that we said in that strategic meeting was things that we've actually accomplished this year. So I'm really proud of the team. We've been able to nail down the things that we wanted to, and I think we are positioning ourselves well for the future.
One thing, I haven't asked it before this way, but I'm always trying to tease out for listeners the value of grad school, the value of post-military work experience. And I'm just wondering, as you kind of look on your journey with Ethos Preparedness, I don't know if it's possible to be this clean on it, but I kind of look at the pie chart of the skills that you've needed. And I'm wondering, what piece of the pie is the military? What piece of the pie was business school? And then what piece of the pie was that industry experience that you gained in private equity?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the piece of the pie from the military is people, hands down. Not being afraid to have tough conversations with people, not being afraid to get to know people. You know, people leadership is the greatest gift that the military can give. And you can either take advantage of it or you can be what I had a couple commanders say, a piece of driftwood. But I learned as much as I could out of that experience in uniform. And, you know, I think my comfort being in front of a group of people and motivating them and persuading them is strong. I think most military veterans would say that's probably one of their assets. The piece that comes from business school for me mostly is the ability to build a framework around the problem you're trying to solve. It's not, hey, Chicago Booth is a financial school, you must be really good at strategic finance and analytical finance. Absolutely not. At the end of the day, I'm still a military veteran and I'm not that great at finance. So I think being able to look at a problem and dissect it and build a framework around it that people are gonna be able to understand, I think that's the greatest thing that I got from business school. And then finally from private equity, it's what we already discussed. It's just being able to analyze an industry and analyze a business and make sure that you're jumping into something that, you know, even if it's not doing great right now, you have a strong vision on where that thing can go and you have a clear path to getting there.
That's great. Could you take us through, I believe it's Red Fora. What's the story behind that?
Yeah. So, oddly enough, I had a Chicago Booth classmate who was doing a search fund as well. And he called me in about November and he said, hey, I met a couple of entrepreneurs out in San Francisco and they had toyed around with potentially selling their business to the right person. And I came across them and I said, hey, Charles should speak to these guys. So I looked them up and found out that Red Fora is the leading online marketplace for emergency kits and supplies. It's a direct-to-consumer business. They've done some B2B, but majority direct-to-consumer. And I was intrigued by it. So I got on a plane, flew out to San Francisco, and sat down with the entrepreneurs who started this in about 2015, 2016. And it turned into a 48-hour session of us just whiteboarding the emergency preparedness industry and how we can do better and how we should partner together. And I spent a little more time thinking about it, but I approached them and said, hey, guys, let's do this. I think we should buy you out and have you guys be a part of the leadership team. Let's figure out a way to make this work. And that's what ended up happening. So MedSled ended up acquiring Redfora. And that is when we decided to build Ethos Preparedness and kind of create an umbrella brand of specialty products that we provide to organizations, families, and individuals.
Did that require you to go back to your investors and say, hey, I actually need more money to buy another company? Or what did that even look like?
So it was a mix. Bank debt is right now a little easier to get than normal, but there was a mix of some seller financing, which for listeners that don't know what that means that the seller is willing to put some of the value on that business on hold and get that paid over time. So there's a lot of different ways to value a company and ways to pay the entrepreneurs or the founders or the owners of that business. And we found a pretty unique way to structure the deal. And it was a way that the two founders stayed on with the team and they're a part of the leadership team at Ethos now.
It's pretty wild to think of two acquisitions under your belt in what the span of two years, right?
Yeah. It was, we closed on the Redfora acquisition almost exactly at a year. So essentially two deals in a year. And, I think there's opportunity to be more acquisitive in this space. I think there's a lot of good small businesses out there that could be a good fit for us. But and I think right now we're still trying to build on what we've done with Ethos, and that is, like I said, I think the best way to describe what we're doing now is Ethos really has two divisions. So there's organizational preparedness and there's personal preparedness. On the organizational side, we have three pillars that we're offering. And that's evacuation equipment, which is the legacy MedSled business more so than anything. We have emergency kits and supplies, which is coming from the Redfora acquisition. And then we offer employee engagement and training. So that third pillar is going to be big for us as we provide the knowledge to back the tools for the companies and hospitals and organizations that we're outfitting with our equipment and supplies.
I think this is a beautiful illustration for listeners of not just the speed at which Charles is operating, which is unbelievably lightning fast in terms of the acquisition and then just how he's expanded, but the I would love listeners to kind of like observe, Charles, your example of like, this is what I view as like true strategic thinking. And again, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I see a story where you are rapidly broadening, rapidly making this thing bigger. And so I perceive MedSled as something that's, we call, I would consider them B2B. It's like a business selling to businesses. He's primarily selling to organizations like hospitals, which that in and of itself is a swim lane that is ample opportunity to spend a lifetime growing that. Yep. But then he expands into B2C or business to consumer of selling something similar, but to individual people, which is a completely different skill set. Marketing is different. Sales is different. Everything. Shipping is different. Every piece of, or not everything, but a lot of it is different. But enough of it's the same where you can kind of scratch your head and say like, oh, I could see how that makes Ethos Preparedness now. It's much bigger. It's not just selling to hospitals. It's selling to people. But then this, I jotted down this training component, which is this jujitsu move where you're like, well, if we're selling equipment to people, we might as well sell knowledge and training and maybe certifications, these other things. And I just want to point this out for listeners, even if I'm interpreting this slightly flawed, it's really incredible to see this big thinking of like, not just thinking as like, I'm in this MedSled business, which is great. You could live a happy life just doing that. But Charles is a great example of like quickly tacking on and in a thoughtful way, expanding this out to it's a much more compelling organization now. And if I'm an investor, I'm like, I can put the dotted line between where they're at now and how this could be a dominant player in a very big industry. And that's just an exciting framework to think through, whether you're at an existing company or you're an entrepreneur, to be thinking of like, how do we inflate this thing to make it even bigger? How do we put on, you know, this is the human growth hormones of business, where he's just massively, you know, quickly putting on muscle. But I haven't seen a lot of examples like this, where it's just like that in my view is true strategy of thinking tangentially and putting pieces together in a way that I definitely lack that viewpoint, but it's pretty awesome to see.
Oh, thank you. It takes a tribe, right? I mean, we for such a small, agile and lean team, we have some strategic thinkers here. And we've got people who have been in the preparedness industry for many years. And you know, I think the MedSled business, like you said, is a fantastic little business. And it could, like you said, stay in its swim lane and do very well for a very long time. But there's an opportunity to just provide more to customers. What our offering is now, there's no one else out there doing it. And we can confidently say that to, you know, whether we were to approach Facebook or we were to approach the Mayo Clinic or we were to approach Chevron and Phillips 66, it's a very compelling story to say, we're going to come in, we're going to assess your facility, assess your team, let you know what we think you need for your preparedness efforts. We'll support you with the equipment. And then on the back end of that, we're going to provide a team of people who are going to come in and engage your employees and make sure they understand why this matters and why it's important that you invested in it as an organization. I think our mission statement is inspiring preparedness to save lives. And that's really what we think about on a daily basis is, did I come in today and did I inspire someone to be prepared for the worst case scenario? It's a perfectly well-suited business for a veteran, because anytime you stepped outside the wire and you filled up your rucksack, you prepared for the worst. And I think when I have that conversation, or when any of our team members have that conversation with a director of emergency preparedness or someone who's in business continuity or resiliency, they can really relate to that question, because that's what their job is. Their job is to think about that worst case scenario. And we're here to help them walk through that and provide the tools and the knowledge to be successful.
I want to call out for listeners, I'll put it in the show notes. I did an interview with Peter Docker forever ago, who works at a company called Start With Why, which is Simon Sinek, who gave this incredible TED talk about the why of a business. And I think I'm like harping on this because it's a skill set I don't have. But when I put myself in Charles' shoes, I'm like, okay, MedSled, I create, pallets to carry human beings. That's what I do. And what I love about that soundbite there, we inspire preparedness to save lives. Is that right? That's incredible. Like, first of all, that is something that like I would get behind, right? Like, that's an incredible mission, but it's also a lot broader than just we build this widget that does X, Y, or Z. Yeah. And in that interview with Peter Docker, he just kind of talks about when you unhinge your thinking to stop thinking narrowly, when you start thinking about like, well, how else could we inspire preparedness? Well, that's training, right? If you had viewed yourself as a widget producer, you wouldn't likely think of training. But when you think of like, hey, Elevated, our bigger mission, our why as an organization is to save lives, that allows you to start seeing new opportunities where you might have dismissed it before. What other advice do you have for people either considering search funds or considering entrepreneurship?
It's a great question. It's a very loaded question. I could spend a lot of time on that one. I hate to do this because I've actually said this exact quote on another podcast I was on about a year ago, but I want to provide this knowledge to veterans who listen to this podcast. And this is a piece of advice that I received from a professor at the University of Chicago. And he knew that I was going to go down this path. And he said, hey, if I could give you one piece of advice, it's when you're evaluating companies, do your business diligence. But for your personal diligence, there's three things I want you to consider. The first is, do you love the product? Are you going to wake up pumped every single day to sell that product? Number two, do you love the customers? So you're going to have this product that you love in your hands. And you're going to be speaking to people that you're really excited to tell them why they should have this and why it's important for their organization. And then the third is, do you like the team? So you got love the product, love the customer, like the team. The team is really the one thing that you can change over time, because you're going to be leading that organization and you're going to want to build the team of people who are rallying around your vision. But the other two are tough to change. You can't just change your product overnight. You can't change your customer base overnight. So as long as you love those things, you will be successful at what you're doing, because you're going to wake up every day with good ideas and you're going to want to get in front of those people and you're going to be proud of what you're selling. And that piece of advice for me was huge. I mean, there was a couple things about the MedSled business that an investor might say, you know, X, Y, or Z. But when I answered those three questions for myself, I said, yeah, I absolutely love this product. I'm intimately familiar with it. The fact that it saves lives is something that I can rally around and put a vision around. I love the current customer base. I love the potential customer base that's out there. And I really got along with the team, those that I was able to meet during diligence. So I think that piece of advice can go for any entrepreneur. If you're going to start up something, you better like the product and like the potential customers, because if you're starting it from nothing, then it's going to be a tough slog if you're not enjoying what you're doing every day.
That's awesome. Well, I know that we are short on time, so I want to just give 4 minutes or so open runway. We kind of had our game plan coming into the conversation. We off-road it a bit, but I just want to make space. If there's anything we didn't talk about or anything else you want to share with listeners, have at it.
Nothing is coming to mind. The only thing that I can say that I would recommend for veterans getting out is pick up some books and read. You just brought up Start With Why by Simon Sinek. I'm an avid reader, and I really never became one until towards the end of my military career and then into business school. And I can't tell you how much you learn just by picking up some good books and reading. I could give multiple examples. I mean, this year alone, I read Stephen Schwartzman's What It Takes. I think that was a fantastic story of becoming a titan in the finance industry. Robert Iger's The Ride of a Lifetime, becoming the CEO of Disney. I'm reading a book right now called Indistractable, which is a book that it kind of forces you to put a framework around your life to not allow your cell phone rule your daily life and to really focus on your family and what matters. Just little things like that, the nuggets you can get by spending some time in a book on a weekly basis, to me has just been a massive opportunity in my personal growth, and I've just really enjoyed it. So that's something that I would love to see more people do.
I love it. And for listeners, I'll add links to What It Takes, The Ride of a Lifetime, and Indistractable in the show notes. Last question, Charles, any way that listeners can support you and the mission that you're up to at Ethos Preparedness?
No. I mean, for those of you that are in organizations and if you're in an emergency management role, I know a lot of veterans end up in that space, but if your organization is looking to increase preparedness efforts, please feel free to reach out directly to me. We would absolutely love to speak with you. We'd love to support your organization however we can. And, I appreciate what you all do. Justin, what you've done with Beyond the Uniform is great. I've been a listener for years. So thank you for conducting these interviews and providing this knowledge to fellow vets.
Awesome, Charles. Well, we look forward to round two of the interview in 2 years when you've acquired 5 more companies and I have to go through a secretary or an assistant to get to an assistant to get to you to schedule this. But really,
that sounds a little stressful, man.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Justin. I appreciate it.
Beyond the Uniform is written and produced by me, Justin Nasiri, with help from our Chief of Staff, Steve Bain, our editor, Kathleen Dillon, and our Head of Social Media, Janelle Hanf. We are an all-volunteer organization and would greatly appreciate your help in any of the following 3 ways. First of all, spread the word. Beyond the Uniform has over 360 podcast episodes and 15 on-demand webinars, all offered for free. Help us spread the word on social media, at military bases, or whatever gets the resource in front of the men and women who need it. Positive reviews on iTunes go a long way towards this as well. Second of all, sponsorship. Beyond the Uniform relies on financial sponsorship to keep us going. There is so much more we'd like to do as well, but just don't have nearly the resources to do so. If you know of a company that would advertise in any way with Beyond the Uniform, please send them our way. Third of all, donations. If you're in a financial position to donate, you can find more information on the support section of our website. At our website, beyondtheuniform.org, you'll find over 360 episodes categorized by industry, functional role, and more. You'll also find both free and for-purchase resources that take a deeper dive on topics related to career growth. Thank you for your support as we aim to help members of the military community thrive in their post-military career and life.